Help KBOO Radio promote our upcoming membership drive, which begins on February 4th. Just go to the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and click on the blue banner to help us thunderclap our drive on social media. And be sure to tune in from February 4th to 14th for lots of special programs and gifts, including the first ever Bluegrass Marathon.
Wondering what to do for Valentine's Day? Sword fights, tap dancing, prizes, and a talent show are just a few of the exciting acts you'll see at this year's KBOO benefit, Contessa de la Luna's Valentine's Spectacular. Don't miss this annual event that is sure to delight and amaze your eyes and ears. Let La Contessa entertain you Thursday, February 12, 2015, at the Clinton Street Theater. This is the perfect Valentine date night. Show starts at 7 p.m. That's Thursday, February 12th, 7 p.m., Clinton Street Theater. Tickets available now. Go to kboo.fm/talent show.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The carbon emissions created by tropical deforestation are well known. Now a new study finds that forests are not just the lungs of the earth, they are the sweat glands. In other words, the moisture they move through their roots, trunks, and leaves helps keep the planet cool to an extent that has never been quantified globally until now. This morning, we talk with the study's author, Deborah Lawrence, about the critical role forests play in directly cooling the earth and generating moisture, not only for the immediate region where deforestation takes place, but for critical food-producing regions thousands of miles away. Deborah Lawrence is a professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia. Deborah, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by talking, before we get into what you mean by the tropical rainforest being the sweat glands of the earth. I've talked with a lot of people who refer to both the tropical rainforests and the boreal forests up north as the lungs of the earth. And what does that commonly refer to?
It refers to the idea that the forests are so vast that they actually exchange gases with the atmosphere a lot. And the idea is that when forests take in CO2, which they do because they do photosynthesis, and that's what they use CO2, when they sort of breathe in the CO2, they actually end up emitting an oxygen. So some have said, well, they're sort of breathing for the whole planet. They are producing oxygen for us. Now, I don't actually think that is 100% correct, because the oxygen in the atmosphere is actually huge. It's a huge store of oxygen, and it doesn't really come from these current trees. It actually comes from algae from the oceans about, 2 billion years ago. So, in fact, I don't think the lungs analogy is actually a really good one. because I think that the oxygen that we breathe is really, it's there, it's been there forever. And the tropical forests, the boreal forests, they're not actually controlling our oxygen.
But they are enhancing it.
But they are controlling the water cycle.
Okay, but before we get to the water cycle, is it true? I mean, this is one of the, at least the common thoughts that people have, whether we're in the city where there's a lot of encouragement to plant lots of trees, or whether we're talking about protecting vast tracts of forests. Isn't true, though, that the forests do help in facilitating like a replenishment of oxygen, even if they aren't creating oxygen?
There is a cycle. Every time a tree takes in a CO2 and does photosynthesis, most of that goes straight back out into the atmosphere. Once the tree uses their own carbohydrates, they make sugars. So they take CO2, they make sugars in their tissues, and they give off the oxygen at that moment. But later on, they use that sugar to do something, like to keep cool or to keep their cells moving around. Then they use that oxygen back up. So in fact, it's really pretty much a net zero unless you have a growing forest, in which case there's a tiny incremental piece of the oxygen cycle that is enhanced. But that's why I said I think it's a strange argument. I know I heard it when I was in elementary school. It's not why I would save the rainforest.
It's an argument I've talked with lots of people who make, so it's very interesting to hear you debunk it, or at least expand on what's really going on.
I'll tell you, the other reason we plant trees in cities, not so much because they give us oxygen, but they actually clean the air. So they take in ozone, which is actually kind of like oxygen. Oxygen has two molecules, two atoms of oxygen, and ozone has three. So plants take up ozone for us, and that definitely helps. So plants do a lot of functions for us in cities. But trust me that they are not keeping the oxygen balance on the planet. There's 20% of our atmosphere is oxygen. And if you think about it, the CO2 is 400 parts per million. And the plants are interacting with all that CO2. And if all of a sudden, if they couldn't do their whole job, we're talking about parts per million that is changing, as opposed to the whole percents of the oxygen cycle. I don't know if that's a good something you can grasp, but it's a vast, vast pool of oxygen in the atmosphere.
Well, the other
compared to how much carbon dioxide is there.
The other argument that's, I think, really commonly made about why we need to protect the rainforest is that they're considered a carbon sink. And so I wanted you to...
Totally.
So let's talk about what that means and why that's important, and then we'll get into them being the sweat glands.
Sure. Okay. Tropical forests hold a vast amount of biomass, and that is really made up of carbon. And they hold so much of that biomass that if, in fact, we deforested them, they would release a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And, in fact, currently, every year, there's about 10 to 15% of all the carbon dioxide that humans put into the atmosphere comes from deforestation. So it's a significant amount. You know, we put in a bunch from fossil fuels, 85% or so, and then the remainder is tropical forests. So it's definitely a huge amount of carbon dioxide, and it's certainly worth sort of keeping that on the earth. The equivalent to think of it is that amount is about as much as we use for transportation, all the cars, planes, automobiles, trains, everything that moves us around is about the same order of magnitude as tropical deforestation in terms of how much carbon we put into the atmosphere.
So let's talk about what you mean now by these forests being the sweat glands of the earth.
So the big thing about forests is, like all plants, they move water from their roots up through their tissues and ultimately out through these little tiny holes on their leaves. And they do that all the time. And forests are just like all other plants. Trees do the same thing as a grass, but a tree has really deep roots, and a tree has a huge amount of leaf area, lots of leaves for a given area on the ground, whereas grasses or crops don't have very deep roots, and they don't have very much leaf area. So they don't move as much water. And so forests just move a vast quantity of water every day. They're able to explore the soil and find all that soil water, and then they move it through their tissues. There's two other reasons that the tropics are especially good at this. Tropical forests, One is that the tropics are at the equator, and so they are getting the sun beating down on them hardest. And so the sun ultimately is what drives this whole process of plants moving water from the soil up to the atmosphere. So the tropics are right there. They're taking in all this sunlight energy, and they have access to lots of water because if we're talking about rainforest, there's lots of water. So they can move a lot of water. And finally, the real key to why we think of them as the sweat glands is just like, you know, you and I, we sweat our brow. It cools us. That evaporation cools us. When you take water and you turn it from liquid, which it is in the soil, to a gas, which is how it comes out of the leaf, that process is cooling. That evaporation is a cooling feature, and it cools the forest locally, and it ultimately, at this vast scale of all the tropical forests on Earth, it cools the planet.
So I'm interested in what's the intersection between this property that forests have of cooling and the other part of their role being that they are a great carbon storage. How do those two factors connect in terms of helping us to mitigate climate change?
Well, that's a great question because, in fact, I think that we've all, as you said to your listeners, we've all gotten our head around the idea that tropical forests are somehow important in the carbon cycle, and that when we keep the CO2 that they trap, when we keep it in the trees, we're doing something for the atmosphere. We're keeping the atmosphere free of some carbon. And because we're emitting less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we are minimizing the greenhouse effect. So that's good, and that's a way that forests, by holding that carbon, are regulating climate. I think what's new here is that we haven't been thinking about the other way that forests regulate climate, this evaporative property, the fact that they are moving water, that they cool the local area, the region, the continent, and even the earth. That is also climate regulation. That is actually giving us the climate that we have. And if we remove the forests, we not only put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and warm it up, but we remove this cooling. So we also get another warming boost. It's a second way that we could end up with warming if we lose the tropical forests.
So let's get into some of the details of what's happening now. Can you tell us about your study and what instigated the study in the first place, and then what did you find out?
I've been studying tropical forests from the ground for 20 years or more, studying soils and nutrient cycling and trying to understand how tropical forests come back once they've been cleared, say for agriculture. What happens to them after that? Do they come back? Do they do the same thing that they used to do? And I've been studying that for years, and increasingly I've been interested in the interaction between these forests that get cut, and I personally have been studying shifting cultivation, which is the way farmers at the very edge of the rainforest, they have been farming this way forever. They go in and they clear a patch of forest, they leave it after they've grown one crop of rice or corn, and then they come back 10 to 20 years later. So I've been studying that forever, and increasingly it was clear that it looks like the forest's coming back, but it doesn't always come back, and in fact, if you add up all of those little patches of forest, you get a significant climate impact. And that has been clear for many years. In, say, before 2010, we thought that the forest deforestation was about 20 to 25% of the global CO2 problem, the human-induced CO2 problem. But after that period, deforestation actually has gone down. So Brazil has had great luck they've had great good fortune to reduce deforestation. So in fact, the proportion of our problem that is related to deforestation has gone down. And as it went down, I thought to myself, you know, is that it? If deforestation is now only 10% of the problem, does that mean that we shouldn't worry about it? Does that mean this is no longer an important issue? And that's when I started getting interested in the non-CO2 part, thinking, my answer was, I don't think that's true. I think the forests do more than just control CO2. And that's when I got interested in these other factors. other climate-regulating factors.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Deborah Lawrence, who's professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia, and she wrote a study called Effects of Tropical Deforestation on Climate Change and Agriculture. So what did you find? Oh, actually, before we get into that, I'm curious about whether rainforests actually grow back. Now, you said that in Brazil, they've reduced the deforestation. Are the places where there were forests that were cut down, are those being restored as fully functional ecosystems that would be providing both the same kind of carbon sink factor and climate control that you're describing?
That's a great question. And that really has been the question I've asked my whole academic life. The answer is, if you leave a forest alone, or, you know, you leave that patch alone after you've cleared it and planted rice, if you left it alone, it would be fine. It would come back within, say, 50 to 100 years, you would think it looked similar, but it probably wouldn't have all the carbon storage yet, and it wouldn't have the same species. But given another 100 years, it would actually have close to the same amount of carbon that was stored before. It still wouldn't have the same species. So you need several hundred years to get back to the same species and to have all of the carbon functions. That doesn't mean those forests aren't useful. Animals can still use them while they're young. Humans can use them for many things. So they do start giving a lot of the functionality back right away, as soon as they become a forest, meaning they get sort of tall and they have a dense canopy. They can be very functional. But that all depends on, I said you just leave it alone. My experience is that in tropical forests, the land never is just left alone. It may be cleared once. It may go fallow for a while, but then usually it's cleared again. That second time, it doesn't come back as well. And then if it's cleared a third time, it doesn't come back as well. It's even slower to recover. And if it's cleared many times, the place can actually have a very hard time recovering. So it depends on how hard that land is used. Is it used for pasture for a long time, over many years, being burned annually so that any woody growth that comes back is snuffed out? If that's the case, it's going to be very hard to get seeds back into that pasture and growing again, because the pasture will be very large and it's just hard for trees to get into the middle of a pasture. So tropical forests, I think, are inherently quite resilient, and they do have a lot of sunshine, a lot of rain. They have all that they need. But we tend to get in the way, and we tend to use them hard, and we tend to not let them recover. So, yes, they could recover. We don't always let them recover.
So what happens in terms of the cooling aspects, the transvaporation and the whole water cycle you described, when we start to cut down certain patches of forest? And what's the difference between having small patches of forest be cut down and having very large areas be cut down?
It's really interesting, because there's some different effects when you cut a small patch out of the middle of the rainforest and when you cut a vast area. So initially, if you're out in the middle of nowhere in a vast area of tropical rainforest and you clear a small patch, you could actually get an enhancement of rainfall. So there's, if you think about it as kind of a smooth carpet, and then you cut a hole in the carpet, you kind of changed the aerodynamics of that surface. It's like it's got a little bit of more bumpiness in it. That patch creates some bumpiness, which can create convection, and it creates movement in the atmosphere that actually can suck, the winds will suck in moist air from the forest nearby, and it will, because it's kind of got a little more turbulence, you can actually get these air masses moving up and you can generate rainfall. So oddly, at a very small scale, you clear a patch of forest and you can get more rainfall over that patch. Now, if you keep making that patch bigger and bigger and bigger, at some point it doesn't give you that plus anymore. At some point it switches to a minus, and all of a sudden the patch is so large that even if there's some wind pulling moisture in from the forest, you know, several kilometers away, it's not enough. And so the drying overcomes that additional rainfall. So there's a tipping point at this small scale where a larger patch ends up being drier. Then if you add that to the fact that, say, we're in this giant sea of rainforest, and we have our one large patch or even a small patch. But we make a checkerboard pattern over that whole area with little patches and then remaining forest and lots of little patches and lots of remaining forest. The little patch acts differently when it's one of many than it does if it's just one by itself. So if it's one of many, it dries out much more. So now we have a small patch that can be wet initially, but gets dry as it gets bigger. But we put that small patch into a big array, a checkerboard, and it's even drier still. Then if we take that checkerboard and just wipe it all out and make it all cleared, then we have a lot of drying. So there's really a sort of an interesting, different dynamic at the very small scales and at the largest scales. Ultimately, if deforestation occurs, on and on and on, you end up with drying.
Now, I'm just wondering, how did you figure that out? What were the steps you took in the study to be able to figure this out?
Sure. Well, I reviewed at least 150 studies of people who have already done this modeling work. So a lot of this work comes out of models that are two types of models that are at the entire scale of the globe, so that every piece of the Earth's surface is represented by a grid cell, a little square box. Most of those are about 100 kilometers, 150 miles on a side. So they're these big boxes, and they're all connected to each other. The ocean is connected to the land. The atmosphere above them is connected. It's a very connected system, so that something that happens to the vegetation can affect the atmosphere, and that might ultimately affect the oceans off the edge of the continent. So everything is very connected. Those are called global circulation models.
And these are computer models, right?
There are those models. Pardon?
They're computer models.
These are computer models, right.
Yeah.
Many layers of information on each of those, what we call grid cells. Then there are these smaller scale models that are maybe just in a local region, maybe a country, and they're much finer scale. So they could, instead of being 150 miles on a side, they might be a few miles. So you could actually see things like hills and mountains and edges of lakes. You could actually see more features in these smaller scale models. So I looked at these, they're called mesoscale models. I looked at the small scale models and I looked at the large scale models, and I simply surveyed all these results and added them together. So people have done individual studies, but no one had really looked to see what's the consensus? What can we say when we look both at the small scale models and at the large scale models? And then on top of that, I added observations. So I said, what are people who are out there measuring things on the ground, what do they say? And how does that relate to these model results? So it was really more of a synthesis. I did not run those models. I was working with all the published studies from many experts who have been using those models for the past couple of decades.
Now, how much consensus was there in these models of like pointing towards the same results, and in what ways were they conflicting?
They were very consistent on the warming impacts of deforestation. So no matter what, if you are talking about a small disturbance, a small patch, or an entire continent, there's always a warming signal, and that came through again and again, that it's always warming. The rainfall story was a little less consistent. So sometimes, I think for the Amazon, for instance, there was a range from maybe 1 to 3 degrees, something like that, a several degree range. So some studies said, yes, I'm sorry, not 1 to 3. Yeah, that was the temperature. So there might have been a range in the temperature, but it was still always positive. On the rainfall, it's a little bit more, there's different ways that those models tend to represent small scale and the large scale. So some studies will show not as much drying. Some studies will show more drying. So it very much depends on the kind of model used. I would say the consensus was that at the largest scales, tropical deforestation results in local rainfall effects. That means a decline in rainfall. But how much, that was debated. Sometimes it was only 5%, sometimes it was 30%. But usually it was a consistent signal of, you know what, if you deforest enough, you're going to lose rainfall in this region.
So what rainforest were you looking at? Because I'm under the impression that it wasn't just in South America, let's say, and there might be differences in the different regions where you were examining the rainforests.
So it was very interesting. I looked at all of the different regions, and that was something else that was unique about the study, because it tends to be that we focus a lot on the Amazon, which is very interesting. And in my study as well, the studies that the research in the Amazon shows the most dramatic effect, so the most significant warming, almost 2 degrees Celsius if you cleared all the Amazon, and also significant cooling. However, in Central Africa, the warming was almost as great, and the drying was similar. So, in fact, also significant effects in Africa. In Southeast Asia, interestingly enough, it was not as dramatic. So only a modest warming, about a quarter degree Celsius, and very modest decline in rainfall, maybe 5%. So it's very interesting. Asia is, all the rainforest is concentrated on a bunch of islands, really, and the peninsula. So a lot of islands in Indonesia and this peninsula. It mostly, it's a bunch of oceans surrounding land. And it turns out, for climate, that how much land and how much ocean you have really determines how sensitive the local climate is to what happens on the land. So in Asia, where there's not a lot of land surface, the effects were much more modest because the oceans kind of swamp it all out. Whereas in Africa and Amazonia, they're massive. These are massive areas of land, and they responded very much. The atmosphere responded, and the whole global circulation responded. So very interesting differences across the regions.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Deborah Lawrence, who's professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia and author of a study, The Effects of Tropical Deforestation on Climate Change and Agriculture. One of the things that I found really intriguing about your study was that the impacts of deforestation in the tropics will affect us here in the Pacific Northwest. So I wanted to talk about why that is. How do the impacts of cutting down rainforests in the tropics affect the rest of the planet?
Isn't that fascinating? To me, this is an interesting indication of how the globe is, how the Earth is really truly one system, because you do something dramatic in a part of the globe that's far away, and you can end up with effects thousands of miles away. Just as you said, if you deforest, what I looked at was, if you deforest one of these tropical regions like Amazonia or Central Africa or Asia, what happens to climate elsewhere? And as you said, there is a strong indication that if you deforest Amazonia or you deforest Central Africa, even if you deforest Southeast Asia, you can get effects in the Pacific Northwest and in California. So, and those effects are not really good. They tend to be a decline in rainfall, which is, you know, problematic if you're looking for a snowpack that's going to supply water for an agricultural area over the course of the entire summer. Your other question was, how does that happen? And it's really interesting. What happens is that if you think of the, as I told you, that the heat, that the sun hits the tropics the most. It's at the equator. The sun's rays are strongest. That's why it's hot there. And so it's driving a lot of heat into the system. And when you mess around with how that heat is dealt with by the vegetation, it actually has impacts on the entire globe. So one way to think about it that I use as a sort of a metaphor is, imagine a pot of water boiling on the stove. And you can, so you think about air over the tropics rising, and it rises, you know, straight up into the atmosphere. Similarly, you're boiling a pot of water on the stove, and the steam is rising up to the ceiling of your kitchen. At that point, it hits the kitchen, the ceiling, and it starts kind of rolling across the ceiling and maybe out into the hall. So the steam actually goes up, it hits something, and then it starts moving in another direction, away from the stove. Similarly, these air masses can move up out of the tropics. They hit some kind of ceiling. It could be a change in pressure. It could be a change in temperature, but it actually functions kind of like a ceiling. And that air mass kind of billows out and moves somewhere else. It actually shifts momentum through the atmosphere, and you know, there are these incredible dynamics that we look at the atmosphere and we think it just looks like a there's nothing there, but it's very well structured. And so giant air masses coming out of the tropics, rising up, they hit something, they have to move somewhere. And as they move, they either carry a bunch of water with them or they don't. And so these movements in the atmosphere over the tropics can end up affecting all of us in the mid-latitudes. So it's really quite interesting that not only do we want the tropical forests to stick around because they're amazing systems and they store a bunch of carbon, but they really are regulating the climate for all of us.
Well, my understanding is that in some places there'll be more rainfall, in other places there'll be less rainfall. So why is that?
Correct. Again, it's all sort of the quirks of the way the atmosphere works. So I can't tell you exactly why one place gets more rainfall and one place gets less. That is still quite an active area of inquiry. So we don't really understand how they call them teleconnections. We don't understand exactly how they work. What we see is that when we run these giant models, based on how we understand the atmosphere to work, we do something down in the tropics and we end up with rainfall changing, you know, in Mongolia. So something happens, there are effects that get propagated out. And we don't know exactly what the changes are, exactly why rainfall is increased in some area and decreased in another, but we know it happens.
So give us an example.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to ask for an example of like where there's going to be more rain as opposed to where there's going to be less rain.
Okay. So it turns out that if you deforested Amazonia, for instance, or let's go with Central Africa, there will be more rainfall off the northeast. So in the Atlantic Ocean, off the northeast, more rainfall. So much more so that it's possible that it would actually go all the way over to Great Britain and end up giving them more rainfall in the winter. So that's one place where you might get more rainfall. It's again with Central Africa, deforest Central Africa, and you can have more rainfall in parts of Southern Africa. So there's a place where you might get less on the coast of Southern Africa, but in the middle you might get more rainfall. There's a place in China, Northern China, where it looks like it's going to get more rainfall. So I would not be, if I were a hedge fund manager, I don't know that I would look at my maps and start making my bets, because I think what the important facts are that there will be effects outside of the tropics. It depends on which model, exactly where you end up seeing the effects, and it's possible that as we refine our models, these little impact areas might move slightly, but what we know is that there will be effects way outside of the tropics. So if we're thinking about food production, food security, global agriculture, we can't act as if what happens in the tropics is going to stay in the tropics. It could definitely affect us. It could affect the Midwest. As you said, it affects the Northwest. It could affect all sorts of important breadbaskets of the world.
Well, a concern like California right now and Southern Oregon is going through a major drought, though I think it was slightly relieved in the last couple of weeks. It seems like there's very little room for California to experience less rainfall than it's experiencing. So what do we do about this?
We do everything we can to be sure that when our global leaders meet in Paris next year, they're all going to make a big climate deal in Paris in December 2015. We make sure that they understand that tropical forests need to be part of the deal, that we need to exhort our tropical forest neighbors to preserve those forests. And if possible, we need to figure out ways to be sure that they do that. Right now, they clear forests actually to grow food. A lot of that food is for us. So we can exert pressure on our politicians to make this global deal. We can also exert pressure on the people who are providing us goods. Anyone who's eaten a candy bar or cake out of a box, or anyone who bathes and uses soap or shampoo, probably has a connection to palm oil, for instance, because palm oil is really the vegetable oil of choice, and it's all being grown mostly in Indonesia, and it's the tropical forest is being cut down to grow that palm oil to produce food and stuff for us. So we can exert pressure on companies saying, you know what, I want you to have a deforestation-free supply chain. Could you please not purchase your palm oil from companies who are deforesting Indonesia? So we can do it kind of privately, and we can also be sure that our politicians hear us, that we want a deal on climate, and we want tropical forests to be part of that deal.
I want to get a little bit more into palm oil. I've done a couple shows about it, but it's been a while, so I think listeners might not know exactly what's going on in Indonesia and why palm oil plantations are such a bad thing. So what happens? How do we get that palm oil that's in our soap or in our candy bar?
Chances are it comes from either Indonesia or Malaysia, which is just north of Indonesia. And if it comes from Indonesia, unfortunately, it probably comes from a peat swamp forest. So peat swamp and forest all sound like three different things. It's a forest that is definitely a beautiful, tall rainforest, but it's on a swamp. And the swamp has really, what do you think, maybe 30 feet of peat, dark, rich organic matter below it. So instead of having your regular soil that's kind of gritty and it would have sand in it and you would feel it, it'd feel gritty, if you pick up soil from a peat forest, it's very kind of slimy and mushy, and it's just organic matter. There is no sand because it's really all organic matter. Well, that organic matter is carbon. It's 100% carbon, and to grow something there that's not a peat forest, you have to clear the forest first and burn it, and that causes a bunch of CO2 emissions. But then you have to drain it because oil palm does not want to grow in a swamp. So you have to drain that swamp. And that would be sort of bad enough just because it's such a dramatic thing to do. But when you drain a peat swamp, all that organic matter is now ready. The microbes get excited because all of a sudden it's dried out, and microbes start working on all that organic matter, and carbon dioxide just flies into the atmosphere. So organic matter that used to be stored in the peat, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 feet of peat under this forest, and it was stored there because it was wet. So if it's wet, microbes aren't too happy. They can't do their job of decomposing and sending that CO2 back in the atmosphere. When you dry it out, which happens when you drain it, the microbes go crazy and the CO2 goes straight into the atmosphere. It's way worse than the original forest clearing. It's, you know, many times that forest, maybe three or four times as much as was in that forest, now comes out of the peat. Then we grow the oil palm and they ship it off to us.
So, and the oil palm forest doesn't have the same capacity either as a carbon sink or as a ability to cool the planet?
Well, I'd say for sure on the carbon sink, it doesn't have enough. I mean, it's they're funny. They're funny trees. They're palm trees. They're maybe at most, I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe 20 feet tall, 30 feet tall. They have to be short because you have to be able to get on a ladder to get the fruits. So if they get too tall, they cut them down and plant them again. So that's as opposed to something you could never climb a ladder into a rainforest tree. It just wouldn't work. So much less carbon storage. As for the ability to move water, I think that they generally have much less leaf area. So I'd have to say they're better than, say, soy, because soy has really very little leaf area. A palm tree and a whole bunch of acres of palm trees has more leaf area than a soy crop or a rice crop or a corn crop, no doubt. So it could move more water, but still not that much and not as much as a forest.
So it seems like there's an awful lot of things that we have to think about that we eat and use in our daily lives that are contributing to deforestation of tropical rainforests. So you mentioned soy, which of course is a major product or component in a lot of food products and other things.
Yeah.
How do we balance the need to protect the tropical rainforests with this need to feed the planet?
Oh, that is sort of the million-dollar question. Well, one thing I would say right off the bat is, back to the original work that you called me about, if we are deforesting the tropics in order to grow food, which is one of the reasons, then we need to be sure we're doing it in a way that doesn't alter the climate and make that food production worse. So we want to be sure that the food that's produced is actually going to be produced in a great long-term sustainable way. But if we've changed the climate and we dried it out, that agriculture is not going to be productive in the first place. So the first thing we need to do is be sure that we plan both forestry. We need to have forests near the agriculture. So if we're going to do it, let's at least do it right and keep really large tracts of tropical forest nearby just so that we can keep the climate regulated. And then beyond that, I think that some would argue that we already produce enough food, and the issue is really how do we move that food around. And so I think that it's not good enough to say we're deforesting the rainforest just to produce food. I think we are, but we're also doing it to produce a bunch of products that are really luxury consumption. And so some of that is something that we can control. And I think, again, the real thing is to try to help companies hear the message from us that we want them to source their products, their commodities, well. We understand that they might be coming from the Amazon, but how about if they come from a place that's already been cleared, similar to Indonesia? Let's use the land that's already been cleared. Let's acknowledge that these countries want development and they want agriculture to be part of their development. But let's just put the incentives in place so that they want to put the agriculture in places where maybe they've already done the clearing. Let's not clear new peat forest in order to grow palm oil for our products.
So one last question, Deborah. Are you happy with the way that the study's getting out? Do you feel like that is you're being heard in the corners of the world that need to listen?
I do. I've had a really fun time with this study, and I've heard from all sorts of people. I've been on on shows like yours, and then I also have been able to speak with some really high policymakers who are going off to those negotiations in December, and they're really interested in hearing what I have to say. So it's been a wonderful experience.
Well, great. Well, thank you for doing the study, and I learned an awful lot reading it.
Great. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure. Thanks a whole lot. We've been talking with Deborah Lawrence, who's author of a study, Effects of Tropical Deforestation on Climate Change in Agriculture. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. And I want to add that at the end of March, we're going to be doing another show about reforestation of tropical rainforests with Rolf Sklar, who's with Greenpeace. So stay tuned for that. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with Mackenzie Funk, author of a new book, Of Ice and Men. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Steve Lacy. Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 38th Annual Portland International Film Festival, which begins February 5th with a screening of Wild Tales at the Fox Tower and continuing through February 21st at many locations all over Portland. This year's festival brings over 150 films from around the globe to the Portland metro area. Again, that's the 38th Annual Portland International Film Festival, running through February 21st. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And we're coming up a little less than a minute before 11 a.m. And coming up at 11 is Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. He speaks today with Dr. Norman Deutsch about the brain's way of healing, remarkable discoveries and recoveries. Stay tuned at 11:30 for Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. And we, of course, want to thank you, all you KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate today. And you are tuned to KBOO in Portland.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Dr. Norman Deutsch, is a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and the New York Times bestselling author of The Brain That Changes Itself, which was chosen by the Dana Foundation for the Brain as the number one book on the brain ever written for the general public. He's on the research faculty at Columbia University's Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, and on the faculty of the University of Toronto's Department of Psychiatry as well. Dr. Norman Deutsch is here today on Health Watch to talk about his latest book, The Brain's Way of Healing, Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity.